Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome to episode... Well, that was a little, overly enthusiastic. Welcome to episode 618 with my buddy Chris Chow. I am Paul Gilmartin. Maybe I'm excited about Thanksgiving. I don't think there's a chance of that. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads, from medically diagnosed conditions, past traumas, and sexual dysfunction, to everyday compulsive negative thinking. This show's not meant to be a substitute for professional counseling. I am not a therapist, and I think that's usually clear after about a minute or two. Are you ready? Are you ready for the triumvirate, the Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, the Holy Trinity? The shit show known as November and December. I don't know why I have always... There's always been a lack of excitement about that for me. And I don't know if it goes back to, you know, my family life growing up, or if I'm just not a traditional person. But I don't know. I always feel this sense of obligation. It always feels like a minor version of helping somebody move. Anyway, let's dive into some surveys. And speaking of surveys, you know, one of the ways, if you enjoy this podcast, and even if you don't, one of the ways you can help it is by going to our website and filling out our surveys. I especially enjoy when people fill out the happy moments or the loves surveys or the awfulsome moments. Any of them are great, but those in particular... Anyway, and our website is metalpod.com. Metalpod also is a social media handle that you can follow us at. Also, if I like how I'm just all of a sudden I've gone into needy mode. I've launched a it's not a website yet, but it's a couple of social media handles for the cynical, satirical, kind of angry, unhealed, comedic part of my brain. And the social media handle for those posts are under Dumbpile. That's D-U-M-B-P-I-L-E. And it's like satirical headlines, like fake Wikipedia entries, famous people's to-do lists. Anyway, yeah, it's almost the polar opposite of what this show is. There's not a lot of acceptance in that part of it, but it's a comedic part of my brain that brings me a lot of pleasure exercising. 'Cause we're all complex. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey, filled out by a guy who calls himself Lou Spowles. And he says, what are your criteria for selecting guests, and what kind of things do you avoid? There are people whom I enjoy hearing, and I would love to hear them as a guest, but not sure if they'd be suitable or not for what you're looking for in interviewees. I wouldn't say there's one particular thing. Variety is important for me, not only of people's challenges, but a variety of cultures, genders, experiences. And I think I look for every episode to have something about it that's either helpful or compelling or entertaining or hopefully all three. So, you know, it's, I don't know if I can put it into words. That's the best way that I can describe it. And I do like to do it in person, and I record in Los Angeles. You know, I had to do Zoom during the pandemic, and I'm just, that is a last resort that I do not like to have to go to. This is from the body shame survey filled out by a trans man who calls himself Joe, and he writes, I like that, to the question, what do you like or dislike about your body and why? He writes, I like that I feel the most comfortable I've ever felt in my body now that I've been on hormones for years and I was able to have top surgery. What I struggle with is bittersweet, of course. I feel so in the middle, having a vagina and feeling like a man, but also socialized as a woman for 30 years. I sometimes have sexual fantasies about being both a penis-having person and also a vagina-having person, a top and a bottom, both masculine and feminine sexual norms. I find this very confusing and also realize that I may never find a partner. Yet the sweetness is, again, I finally feel comfortable. That comfort comes with isolation and a lack of intimacy in my life. I suppose this is the part of the sadness of being trans in our culture. I know there are people out there who find my body attractive, but it is rare. I've thought about sex work so that I can have intimacy, but it may be the only way to find it. I enjoy passion and intimacy and care within an anonymous setting, and it is fitting considering my difficulty with attachment. Of course, I am imagining a safe, privileged version of sex work, which I have no idea how to navigate. I simply miss touch and intimacy, and I wish I could retire this longing. You know, it's ironic that I read this right after that question, because this is an example of a person that I think would be a great guest on the podcast. And Joe, if you're listening and you're in Los Angeles, or you plan to get to Los Angeles, I would like to talk with you some more. Because as you guys know, the trans community are up against a lot. There's a lot of misunderstanding. I have a lot of, I wouldn't say misunderstandings, but blind spots and areas that where I'd like to learn more. And I think I think there are compelling conversations. And you seem like a cool guy, and I like this survey. I love stuff where it's bittersweet, because isn't so much of life in that range? The push and the pull and the, you know, the brain's way of wanting to categorize something as good or bad when it's so rarely one or the other. Anyway, thank you for your survey, Joe. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by a guy who calls himself, I feel icky and have trouble trusting people. Well, buddy, let's start a support group. Oni, what gender do you identify with? And he writes, meat popsicle. What would you like to ask Paul? Hi, Paul. You've mentioned support groups a few times on the podcast, and I wondered what, if any, experience you've had with people who seemingly take over groups to feed their need to feel in control of others and or at the center of everything, and how did you deal with it? And there's more to this survey, but I'll just kind of condense it by saying he's talking about support groups and somebody coming in that's a narcissist and who begins to kind of cross boundaries and really push people's buttons and tries to take charge and very often has no idea that they are subjecting people to their control issues. And on the plus side, it is an opportunity for the other people in the support group to practice speaking up for themselves, for establishing boundaries, to begin to understand, in essence, the serenity prayer when it comes to another person. What do I have control over and what do I need to let go of? And it can be a great opportunity to work on that skill. That being said, it fucking sucks when somebody comes in. And I have left specific meetings because of toxic people that I just couldn't take anymore. And the thing that he is having trouble with is it's the only in-person meeting in his area. So I would recommend finding some online, some Zoom support group meetings. And I know it's not as good as an in-person one, but I have seen meetings literally empty over a six-month period by a person who is sick. And I also try to use it as an opportunity to not give in to hating and resenting that person, but saying, what are my options? My options are to either accept that person as they are, speak up when my boundaries are crossed, or choose to not come into contact with them by either keeping my mouth shut or going to other meetings. But it's a hard one, man. It is a hard one. But like everything, there's also this kind of good side to it, that it's, you know, it is a tool for spiritual strengthening. There are people who become our spiritual gym and they don't even know it. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. I've been using BetterHelp for 6 years. Love the relationship I have with my therapist, Heidi. She gives me great perspectives on the things that I am struggling with. Sometimes the struggles are big. Sometimes they're little, and it's just little adjustments and tweaking. And I got to be honest, since I started, since I've given up video games about 6 months ago, I feel like I'm really thriving, but there's still a part of my brain that wants to look at everything negatively, and it helps to have her perspective for that. And I think that's one of the things that's great about therapy is, you know, our brains don't come with a user manual, and I think therapy can be a great way to break out that manual and help us understand what's going on inside our skull. As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists, available 100% online, plus it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/mental. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp, HELP.com/mental. And make sure you include the slash mental part so they know you came from the podcast.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And then finally, this is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Quivering Puddle of Snot and Tears, which I think is the worst Cheesecake Factory appetizer. I strongly discourage you from ordering that. About her alcoholism, my drug dealer is the closest thing I have to a friend, and I don't even think he likes me very much. About her love addiction, I'm worthless now that I'm old and no one finds me attractive. About her sex addiction, a guy could have sex with me until his penis fell off, and I would be hurt that he couldn't have sex anymore. About her skin picking, I constantly pick at my face because I feel so ugly, causing permanent damage that makes me look even worse. about experiencing racial or cultural bias. People asking me, where are you from, after I'd been given up for adoption, spent over 2 years in an orphanage, ended up in a house with an alcoholic, emotionally absent sadist, and an alcoholic, emotionally abusive martyr who never considered me to be a part of the family and fetishized constantly by creepy old men with yellow fever. It's like asking a rape victim out of the blue, so what was the name of your rapist? Because they look like they had been raped at some point in their life. Wow. If you are listening and you have never heard the episode with Julie J., listen to it. I believe it is available. I know we've run it as a best of. So anybody that relates to that part, especially the part about being adopted. There wasn't so much the racial cultural aspect to Julie's interview, but it's a great interview. And then a snapshot from her life. As I was writhing in pain during a contraction while in labor with my son, my mom got right in my face and said, I have two words for you. Birth control.
Your fear of death is your love of life in reverse.
I'm a kinky person.
I didn't want to be...
I'm ashamed.
A sexual being.
Deeply ashamed.
You are...
I want to live...
Fucking depressed.
But how?
I can't do this anymore.
I will be uncomfortable so you will be comfortable.
Is life just a series of perpetual losses?
You're not depressed. We're black.
There is no real chance for intimacy.
We don't do that.
Without... risking being hurt.
Push it all down.
You can't go around it.
Ireland, like, we don't do mental health talk.
Through is the only path.
No one is ever alone. There's somebody else out there.
Don't forget.
Experiencing the same thing as you.
But the places you feel most broken now.
You just gotta look for them.
Will one day be your greatest strength.
And when you find them, it's a great feeling.
And I'm suddenly feeling horrible about making that joke, but that's how far I will go to get a laugh because I am empty inside.
Ah, you're in the right place.
I'm here with my buddy Chris Chow, who I've known for, what, probably 8 years, 10 years, something like that?
Yeah, it's like a decade.
A decade. Yeah. A solid decade of watching each other cry on Wednesday nights.
Realizing how old we've become.
Actually, the years of us sobbing and support group meetings, it's been a long time, I think, since all the pain and the poison came out. But I had the privilege of watching Chris come in a couple of years after I did and begin to process a lot of the things that I processed in my life, a toxic relationship with a mother, an inability to stand up for myself. Yeah. No sense of who I was as a person. Chris is nodding his head up and down. And first of all, I just want to say I really appreciate your friendship. You know,
same.
You're somebody that I've always felt comfortable opening up to. Before I say anything more, let's go back to your childhood and talk about kind of what brought you in. You're first generation Asian American.
Mm-hmm.
Your parents are, remind me again where?
They were both born in Taiwan. I was born in Taiwan as well.
Okay.
So we were all born in Taiwan. They came from big families.
Mm-hmm.
Our family is not that big, so it's a little different.
How old were you when you moved here?
First grade. So what is that? Seven?
Yeah, six, seven.
Yeah.
Did you speak any English?
No.
Wow. I never knew that about you.
Yeah. I knew yes and no. And
that's all you need.
And then my parents just put us in school right away. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. The first.
What was that like?
I got in a lot of trouble.
You did?
Yeah, because I didn't because we were in the local public school. I didn't speak any English, so people made fun of us. And the only way to counter that was to be angry. And I got suspended once, actually.
What do you do?
I brought a plastic butter knife to school to threaten I remember this vividly, like this girl who was just making fun of me the whole time. And I didn't know what she was saying. I just knew that it was not good.
Yeah.
And then she called the teacher when I pulled the butter knife out. And then they called my mom and I got sent home.
Wow.
So.
Were you also tall for your age back then? Chris is what are you, 6'3"?
6'5".
6'5".
Yeah.
And one of the things that when you share your story is you will frequently talk about being a 6'5", Asian, bald guy, and it's difficult to blend in when you want to just be a fly on the wall.
Yeah, you know what's interesting was I felt unseen for most of my life.
Right.
Like I could be in the room and everyone will see me and my vision or my perspective of myself was not that.
So you've never felt that you wanted to hide more?
Oh, I always wanted to hide more.
Okay, so maybe I was misinterpreting what you were sharing. So it was kind of this weird dichotomy of you don't feel seen, but it's still too much.
Yeah, yeah. Like what I thought was I was being seen was I wasn't being seen, but I still felt like I didn't – like I was being seen too much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and this growing up with this understanding of that we needed to be perfect – to be seen. Mm-hmm. And I was never perfect. So I felt even worse about myself and not wanting to be seen.
And that seems to be kind of a, I don't know if the word would be stereotype, but a common thing in Asian households. The drive to be successful.
Yeah.
A lot of concern with what the neighbors think, and not that that is, you know, certainly unique to Asian culture, but mm-hmm. you share a lot about that. Talk more about that.
Yeah, it's we were immigrants, and we were told, you know, my parents didn't hide that from us. They told us, you know, you're immigrants, you needed to be better. We needed to be straight A students. We needed to be perfect. And if someone says something wrong about us, we don't counter that or stand up for ourselves. We just, you know, we don't want to make waves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very much like Asian culture early on. Oh God, what was that? Like late 80s kind of,
mm-hmm.
where you just wanted to be the model, like the quote unquote model minority, which is a myth, you know, but that's what we wanted to be. You know, we wanted to go to the best schools. Like everyone wanted to go to Berkeley. Oh, actually, let me go back one more. Everyone wanted to go to Lowell High School. If you're from San Francisco, you know what Lowell High School is.
Mm-hmm.
The population in that school is primarily Asian.
Mm-hmm.
I obviously was not good enough of a student to actually get in there, even though the rest of my extended family that grew up in San Francisco all went.
And that was a high school?
Yeah, it was a high school. And then everyone was supposed to go to Berkeley because that's what you're supposed to do. I didn't have good enough grades to go to Berkeley.
Right. San Francisco has a large Asian population. Do you feel like it was easier to not feel like an outsider there than in, for instance, in California, where there's still a large Asian population, but maybe not as big?
Yeah, very much so. Like I never... You know, and I don't know if it's good or bad in that sense that growing up in San Francisco, we never felt like we didn't belong.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we always just felt like we were American, mm-hmm. like we were told we're American. And we acted like that, and which kind of in many ways is to the detriment of the culture itself, because, you know, we didn't recognize us as being a different race. Like we were just part of the mass American race, and mm-hmm. you know, like don't make any waves.
Right. How do you think specifically coming from Taiwan and its complicated relationship with China has affected kind of the mentality and attitudes of your family or Taiwanese families in general? I know that's kind of a broad question, but
yeah, I think Taiwan, well, I think it's different. I think there's two different trains of thought and two different groups of people in Taiwan. Like, there's one group who, you know, who believe they're truly there. We're separate from China. We're Taiwanese. Mm-hmm. We're a different country. And then there's another group that just believes that we're still part of China. We don't want to live the way they live, mm-hmm. but, you know, we're still Chinese, and that, you know, if everything goes to hell, we can still go back to China, you know. And by everything goes to hell, I mean, you know, our past president, previous president, where there was a lot of Asian hate. Like, if it had gotten to a place where,
you know, oh, I see. You mean Taiwanese Americans?
Yeah. Or just Taiwanese in general. If if it comes down to it, like, we're always welcome back to Taiwan, but we have to live the way of the Chinese government and not the free society of Taiwan.
I see. So how liberals feel about Canada?
Yeah.
So talk about your relationship with your parents, and also in the context of your younger brother. You have a special older brother.
Yeah.
I like how I'm like, Chris is my best friend, and then I get nine things wrong about you right out of the gate.
So it was interesting, right? I grew up, I for a long time didn't understand what was wrong with my brother. But I was always told that my brother was my responsibility for the rest of my life. That
by both your parents?
By both my parents. That, you know, you have to take care of your brother. And you know, and for me at the time, I think I was in fifth grade or sixth grade is when that started. You know, I didn't understand that.
In addition to the responsibility your parents had, or in place of the responsibility?
In addition to at the time, and then in place of them once they pass. And then they just made me keenly aware that he was my responsibility. Mm-hmm. Like, doesn't matter what I do in my life, my brother is always going to be my responsibility. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and probably didn't need to be told that. I think ultimately I would have known that, you know, mm-hmm. like, I got to take care of my family. But it was just constantly reinforced that, you know, you need to make sure you're taking care of your brother. Like, if we go out somewhere, take care of your brother. If my parents decided to travel, you know, and didn't want to take us, then it was my responsibility to take care of him.
Talk about your dad and his presence or lack of.
So my dad, early on, was great. You know, we were a normal family. You know, when we moved here, my dad would drive me to school. Once I changed schools. I went from that public school that I had that incident at, and I got I went to a Catholic school, and the priest, the Monsignor at the school, was a client of my dad's. My dad worked for an elevator company, and they had a private elevator in the rectory. Mm-hmm. And my dad just happened to be the sales rep,
right,
for that account. And he and the Monsignor just, you know, they chatted one day, and he said, "Yeah, your son will come to my school."
Really?
Yeah.
And so do you think that was a good thing?
I think so.
Yeah.
So I went to St. Bridget's in San Francisco. Early on, it was a little weird because every quarter that we get our report cards, mm-hmm. the Monsignor would come around to look through everyone's and hand it to you.
Oh, God, we did that too at my Catholic school, the most nervous day of the entire year.
Yeah.
And you're trying to read his face as he's handing it to you.
But on top of all of that stress, he would say, "Well, I'm going to have a conversation with your dad about this." So that was my childhood.
And by what age were you fluent in English?
I think by third grade, I think I was pretty much able to speak and write. And so about two years.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. think I was at that place where I was able to absorb really quickly, and I think television helped.
Interesting.
So,
which shows do you remember?
What is that? Growing Pains, I think, was one. Degrassi High, remember that? But yeah, just a couple of shows and just watching TV.
So talk about, and at what age did your father begin traveling? Because, go ahead.
So my freshman year of high school, actually, is when he moved abroad. He took a demotion to move us to the States. Mm-hmm. And then he got a promotion to go to China to run the sales and marketing team for his company for the entire Pacific Rim. So it was a wow. substantial job, and we flew. So they flew us there every winter and summer. And it was great. We were flying business class. We stayed at a hotel where he stayed, and we were, in a suite. And
where in China?
In a place called Tianjin, which mm-hmm. is kind of north of Beijing. Okay. And yeah, it was great. I can go into the hotel kitchen and tell them, hey, I like spaghetti today or something. And they would just make it because we were long-term guests.
Wow.
So it was great. But it also meant that he wasn't here.
You weren't over there.
Yeah. From like 13 years old on, he wasn't here every day.
So then let's segue into your relationship with your mom.
Yeah, which meant I was also the dependent for her, like
spousified.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, and early on, you want to be a good son and you want to mm-hmm. do everything you can. My grandma lived with us for a little bit as well, but she was at an age where it was an extra person to take care of. It wasn't really like, hey, she could help us, mm-hmm. and so it was a lot. Like I had to grow up really quickly.
How many times a day as a kid or even as an adult would you hear a controlling or critical remark from your mother?
I mean, even to today, I would hear it. Like they were...
Like once a day, twice a day?
Yeah, probably like twice yeah. or three times a day.
And give me an example of kind of a typical...
Oh, like just yesterday, I was out picking up dinner. It was my brother's birthday, so I went to get dinner. And she felt compelled to send me a text and then call me and to tell me that I need to call the restaurant directly and not order it through one of the service because she hates it when I have to pay a fee for the service. And, and meanwhile, I'm not asking her to pay for it. I'm paying out of my pocket. Right. And yet she doesn't like, she hates it that I am spending that extra like dollar per plate on some food that, that I'm ordering out of my pocket. And, in some sense, that's nice for a reminder, but, mm-hmm. But the way that it's done, it's like, mm-hmm. it's just this constant nag of like, you're like, how can you be that stupid to spend that money?
Right. You still live at home.
Yeah.
And you're how old?
46.
Talk about that decision and the battle that goes in your head. You have a girlfriend, Anne, yep. but she lives in another city. She's a flight attendant.
Yeah.
Or is that the right word?
She's a flight attendant. So when she's here, we live together. Mm-hmm. But she travels a lot.
Okay. So she comes to your family's
yeah.
house
yeah.
and lives with you.
Yeah.
So why still be at home at 46?
I think partly it was the guilt of like leaving them to
your brother and your mom.
Yeah. To fend for themselves. I think mm-hmm. some of it is where my dad would remind me like, hey, make sure you take care of your mom and brother. Mm-hmm. And so it's the guilt of it. And Asian guilt is tough to deal with. And then some of it, you know, is for Anna and I to save money so that, you know, once she's in the process of becoming a pilot, mm-hmm. For an, trying to, you know, get her hours so she can apply to work for an airline. And for us to save up and to then move out when at the point where she finally gets a pilot job, that we can have a place of our own.
And is that going to be a surprise to your parents when you move out?
Probably, yeah.
Talk about the feeling that you get when you think about that.
It's, well, you know, it's anger. Like, it's real anger that, you know, like, I need to have a life. And my life needs to be mine, and it can't be them in it with me. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, they're still my family, and I'm obviously going to make sure they're okay. But if I move to, you know, the East Coast, or if I move abroad, it's not by default that they're moving with me. Like, and I feel like a lot of times that's what the thought is. If I say, hey, I'm moving to Singapore tomorrow, they'll get angry, and then, you know, they'll have, you know, their shit fit about it, and then they'll say, like, a week later my mom will say, oh, you know, we'll move with you too.
And how do you feel about that?
And that's the line that I will not cross, let them cross.
And do you feel like the work and the support group has enabled you to feel confident in that decision?
For much more now than before.
And what do you mean by that?
Being able to say no to them.
Right.
It's definitely being able to kind of stand up for myself and mm-hmm. say, you know, like, this is my life. You know, I'm probably going to deal with it in a few weeks when, so Anne is in South Dakota mm-hmm. right now for flight training. And so she's not going to be able to come back for Thanksgiving or be at her dad's place, where her dad's 99, by the way. So my goal is that, well, then my responsibility is to go and spend time with her over the holidays in South Dakota. And I'm sure my mom will have a fit about it, saying that I'm somehow leaving the family. And even though we don't really celebrate Thanksgiving the way that, mm-hmm. you know, you see it on TV, but she'll still have a fit about it.
One of the things that I remember in our support group, it was when you had a commitment. I think you were secretary of the meeting. For those of you not familiar with support groups, it's probably the most important position in a support group because support groups are autonomous.
Yeah.
And a secretary position can be kind of delicate in that there are rules to follow. And as you can imagine, a lot of sick people yeah. come into support groups, and sometimes you gotta, you know, lay down the law firmly but lovingly. And you would do it, but your face would get super red, and I could hear this rage in your voice. Am I portraying that accurately?
Yeah.
Talk about the beginning of setting boundaries as an adult for the first time in your life and what it feels like.
You know, what's interesting was it was over 5 or 6 years ago, someone decided to nominate me to be the chair of our entire Los Angeles chapter. Mm-hmm. And so I would run our monthly meetings for the entire LA group. And these were just people who were leading their meetings who mm-hmm. are naturally opinionated and mm-hmm. who have no boundaries. Mm-hmm. And there was, it was just screaming and yelling, and like, wow. And people hated each other. And I was there sitting there thinking, like, how did I get myself in this? Right. And there were many days where I wanted to stop and just say, you know, I don't need this, mm-hmm. but I stuck it out. And I think what I did was I held a boundary for myself in that, you know, like, yeah. At the end of the day, I got to make sure this meeting actually runs. Mm-hmm. And however way I need to get through to the people who are you know, the liberally being like angry about not being heard. I got to figure out a way, but I wasn't going to let them like take over.
And what did you, if anything, take out of that experience?
That, you know, like I was that, you know, I had a voice and people listened to it. Mm-hmm. You know, and because, you know, the other thing was like, why would anyone want me to run anything? And people would come up to me afterwards and say, hey, you know, appreciate your leadership. And I'm there thinking, I what leadership are you talking about? But it was just, you know, I look at it as my job wasn't to try to be a dictator. Like, you know, everyone has to do it the way I do. I was trying to empower people to speak up. And that's like when, if I'm a secretary of a meeting and we have, you know, our business meetings, I just try to, you know, make sure that the room is kind enough and give people the ability to raise their hand and say, you know, and get their voices heard. Mm-hmm. And for many people, I feel like that's the first time they're being heard. It definitely was for me. So
was there a progression of, was there initial anger at the chaos?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Did that ever morph into something different than that? And how did you deal with that inner volcano?
Yeah, there was definitely a couple months where I did not want to do it. And I would have that conversation that I wanted to have with the few people that were just being, you know, they were just being the way they were. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't have that conversation with them. Mm-hmm. Like I would have that conversation with someone else. And,
gotcha.
You know, and what I've learned through that process is that's the easy way to do it. Just, you know, you have the conversation that you want to have, but you're not talking to the actual person. Gotcha. And my change today is that, you know, while it's uncomfortable, I need to have that conversation with the person that it affects. Mm-hmm. And to let them know, like, you know, hey, let's try it this way. Like, we're trying to hear you, but, you know, maybe, like, widen your tone a little so people can hear you, because I feel like you have great ideas. I just want people to make sure they hear you.
Was that hard to say that instead of, you fucking nut job, shut your face?
Yeah, I think, yeah, there are many times where I'm like, just go away. But I think I got through to a couple of them, so.
And I think, kind of the general theme of the support group that Chris and I are in is struggles with intimacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that had never occurred to me before I came in there was that intimacy can also apply to platonic and business relationships.
Yeah, very much so.
And in many ways, that can be the template then for a romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. Because you have to develop communication skills to stand up for yourself. Take from here and kind of.
Yeah, you know, like I think in a normal childhood, you're taught to, you know, those tools. You're given those tools to learn how to protect yourself, not only physically but, you know, spiritually and mentally. Like you learn how to say no. Mm-hmm. I never was given those tools because I was never given the opportunity to say no. It was always yes. You know, like, yes, I'll do that and I'll take care of that. I took that into the world and, you know, and very quickly felt overburdened and needed to figure out a way to not feel stressed. And I didn't know how to speak up for myself either. And then what I learned in the rooms, like, I think the most important thing I learned in rooms is that
by rooms, support groups,
the support groups, yeah, is that how I placed the order of my life needed to be me first. Mm-hmm. Because I put everyone first. I still remember to this day, like, and someone who had been there for a long time just asked, like, you know, how do you see your life? And I, like, how do you, what order do you put people at? And I was always like, well, I put everyone, just want to make sure everyone's okay. And then, you know, and I, you know, I'm Catholic, so I'm like, maybe I'll go to church. And then if I have time for myself, and, you know, I'll try to do something for myself.
Right.
And he just said to me, he was like, that's the complete opposite. Like, you need to put yourself first. Like, you have to have your own life. You have to know who you are. You have to know what you want. Mm-hmm. And before you can actually help anyone.
Talk about somebody listening who thinks, well, that sounds selfish. You know, yeah. Putting yourself first. I mean, would it be fair to say that that doesn't mean you always put yourself first, but there are times you need to be selfless and of service.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was how I felt first when I heard that. It's like, well, that just makes me feel really selfish. Like, mm-hmm. you know, shouldn't I, you know, be a good Catholic? We're told, like, you know, you want to be sure to be there and help those who can't help themselves. But I think the thing that I never was taught was, like, how do I help someone if I need help? Mm-hmm. Like, if I don't know what I stand for or who I am as a person, then where do I come? Like, how do I approach someone that needs help when I don't know what to offer them?
Don't know what my needs are, how to ask for them.
Yeah.
How to set boundaries.
Yeah. And then when they ask me, like, well, what do you do in this situation? I wouldn't have an answer because I don't know what the answer was at the time.
Before you came into support groups, what percentage of the time would you say that you felt drained and overburdened by life and responsibilities? And what do you think that percentage is today?
I think it was probably like 80-20. It was everyone else. I would give up, you know, responsibilities that I have for myself to try to be better for them. And then today, I think it's more even. It's probably 50-50. Like, there are days where, you know, I just can't do something, and I'll just say, like, I can't get away. Like, you're going to have to do it yourself. But I still try to be there and offer support, but just not physically.
Talk about, if you're comfortable, the unhealthy ways that you coped with your feelings before you came into the support groups.
Yeah, it's, you know, I am grateful for the fact that I never really enjoyed alcohol to the point. Mm-hmm. So it was, so I didn't have a true alcohol problem. I mean, I drank to not feel.
Right.
And I drank to get myself to a place that if I didn't feel, then I can say the things I want and not have to worry about it.
And that would be at night or during the day?
It's mostly at night.
Okay.
You know, like, I ate a lot. I ate to feel better about myself. I did, you know, like, escorts, strip clubs, you know. I even went to a rave, so.
Well, that's hitting rock bottom, Chris.
And I used to think, like, well, I don't feel anything, so then maybe this is kind of cool. Right. Like, whatever you just gave me, sure.
Yeah. And did you attend it with friends? Did you go by yourself? What was that experience
I
like?
I went with people who I thought were friends, but it was just really just kind of acquaintances that I wanted to be part of something.
And did you feel part of something there? Did you take ecstasy?
I tried it once. Yes, it's. I don't remember too much about it, but
right.
You know, it definitely didn't feel anything afterwards. But
after you took it,
yeah. But I think in the moment, you kind of felt like I was part of something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was in this group. Like, I was like, well, hey, we're doing the same thing, whether it was healthy for me or not.
Right.
But I was part of something.
And was there physical affection, which I guess is kind of said the 100-year-old man, I hear the kids do at the rave.
Yeah. So yeah, like, people are much more affectionate. Like, you know, it's all about peace and love, and not really, but it's, you know, you kind of just feel like, well, hey, someone's hugging me, that's great, let's make out. And just kind of a lot of that inhibitions that I had were just all went away because, you know, I wasn't mentally present. I was physically present, but I wasn't really there.
Right. And the strip clubs, would you go there by yourself?
Yeah.
Talk about that.
It was just, you know, I think initially it was just to kind of get the hit of, like, having someone be interested in talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it was just that. It wasn't really sexual. Like, I wasn't interested in, like, oh, you know, I need to, you know, make sure I go and date this person.
Right.
But a lot of it was just for that that mental intimacy. Mm-hmm. Like, just having someone pay attention and be, whether they were fully interested in you or not, or just, or, you know, and forgetting the fact that you're paying.
Right.
But it that was what was the draw.
And I think it's a great example of the tool of fantasy for the unhealed person to cope.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Yeah, it was very much, that was my life. It was just trying to make sure that these girls were part of my life and that they were interested in me. And if it was me saying, like, paying for something, that was great, because, you know, that was fine for me, because that's how they, that's how I felt part of something. Mm-hmm. that was important. And the truth is, you know, you go into a strip club, it's dark for a reason. You know, like, you can't really see who you are. There's no windows for a reason.
There's no mirrors.
Yeah, there's no
mirrors for the patrons.
Yeah. And then not even taking into account the fact that, you know, if some girl is doing it, they might have a reason why they're doing it, or they might be struggling with something. So there was, mm-hmm. so it was someone that's, you know, I wasn't a sober person at the time either. Mm-hmm. And you might be dealing with someone who's dealing with issues themselves. Mm-hmm. And then when you put two and two together, that doesn't turn out well.
And was the fact that they might be in a position of desperation or vulnerability, was that even on your radar?
Yeah, I think eventually it did. That part of me came into play where I was like, you know, well, maybe I can offer more than just money. Like, what if I was, you know, I was a shoulder to lean on? Mm-hmm. And then they would show me the affection because I helped them through some thing. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, in my head, that was a relationship. And, you know, that was my relationships for a long time.
And talking about it now, looking back, how does that feel, talking about that?
I feel in many ways it was sad and pathetic. You know, if I was truly honest, it feels pathetic that that's where my life was and that I was willing to pay for it.
Are you able to have any empathy
for me?
For me?
Yeah. You know, I can see today where I was at the time was, you know, I was searching for something. I was trying to search for community and friendships. And I think I was in so much fear of actually trying to do that in real life that this felt like the safer option for me.
Like training wheels for an intimate conversation.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that sex workers will often talk about is a lot of their clients just want to be held and talk.
Yeah. 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 No, that's, I've been told that too.
Yeah. There's a saying that everything is about sex except sex.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of true in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And, you know, and there have been days where I've been out where, you know, like where some girl is just staring at me and they're like, hey, remember me? And it would be someone
from the club.
But because of the lighting issue, they were in lingerie most of the time. Mm-hmm. And it was like not really something that, you know, you put in the top of your memory. Like, oh, I remember you.
Sure.
Definitely, you know, so.
And how did you feel when they would say that? Did it ever happen when you were with Anne?
No.
Okay.
No, but like when I was alone early on in the recovery rooms, mm-hmm. I had met some of them outside, or just by, you know, sheer chance, mm-hmm. you know, and that still was a hit. That was like, you know, it made me feel good.
Seen.
Yeah, definitely seeing. And then that was maybe important enough that mm-hmm. they remembered.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like when you made the decision to disclose to Anne in your relationship what your history looked like?
You know, what was interesting was, like, a lot of this, none of this was really within my control. She called me one day and said, you know, we needed to talk. Mm-hmm. One of her best friends, I guess, was dating at the time. And apparently she got matched up with me on one of the dating apps. And then she obviously called Anne right away and said, you know, did you guys split up or something? And mm-hmm. so she called me and told me. And what is essentially what happened was I just deleted the app off my phone. I didn't realize you actually have to actually delete the account.
I gotcha.
And so I didn't get to, like, set up that conversation, like, you know, hey, like, you know, let's go out for dinner and this is when I'm going to tell you. It was just, you know, God basically said, it's time for you to say this. And if you're not going to do it, then I'm going to make sure you do it.
So she was unaware you were in a support group.
Yeah, she was unaware. And then I told her, yes, you know, I would love to be in a long-term relationship with you. And, you know, I want to be exclusive. But I just want to make sure you know that, you know, I go to a support group. This is my history. I am, I'm a better person today than years ago. And you're getting the best of what I am at the moment. And, I just wanted to make sure you knew that.
And how was that received?
I think she was okay with it. I mean, we're still together.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And talk about what you felt after you shared that.
It felt relief. Like, it felt like a burden kind of went away. It also felt like, you know, like it took some of the power of the addiction away. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of addiction is about hiding.
Shame.
And the shame of it.
Yeah.
And the more open I am about it, the less power it has over me.
Talk about what struggles are kind of still there. I mean, you've for what, how many, 8 years?
Yeah,
like, you have not engaged in the behavior that used to be addictive for you.
It's you know, it's still, I still get to those points where you know, where I feel the anger and even in my relationship, you know, we've mm-hmm. been together for so long. There are still days where I have a hard time just saying what I want to say, mm-hmm. and worried about the reaction. And that's me inside my head in that addiction part of my head.
And home field advantage for the addiction.
And so that's still a struggle. But I think it's less so in that I get to, you know, whether I say right away, I eventually will get to share my feelings.
And what does that sound like? What are some typical ways that you will share your feelings?
I'll just say, you know, like, you know, hey, like what you did, this is how it made me feel. Mm-hmm. So I wanted you to know that. And you know, and I'm not asking them to act a certain way, but I'm just letting them know that this is how it made me feel.
Yeah. And it's such a great tool because it doesn't put them... it doesn't corner them. It doesn't assign, you know, some type of qualitative adjective to who they are as a person.
Yeah.
Because you can't argue with how somebody feels.
Yep.
Or at least a rational person wouldn't.
Yeah. My mom probably would, but, you know, but that's a whole different story. But normally I'm able to share, like, you know, like what you did made me feel this way. I just mm-hmm. wanted to make sure you knew that. Mm-hmm. And that's it. I don't have to say, like, you know, please change.
Right.
Because I don't have that power. As much as I would like to think I can, right. I just don't have that power.
Anything you'd like to share before we wrap up?
I just, you know, I think the idea of shame is really, like, is still really strong, right? Like, it's, like, there are still days where I'm like, how do I tell someone, like, that, hey, I'm in recovery? Mm-hmm. I've done that. I didn't, you know, I don't openly say which program it is, but mm-hmm. I've done that in, like, was it last year or the year before when there was the Asian hate going on? And we had a couple of meetings at work with the Asian employee group. And we're just talking about, and they're listening to people struggle, talking about their struggles and like how they feel about everything. And, you know, and I opened up, I just said, you know, look, I have to share, this is how it's making me feel. You know, I'm a sober person. And if I don't like tell someone, you know, how their actions have affected me, then I'm.
Around you being Asian?
About me having my addiction.
Oh, I
then,
see.
Then I'm going to go and act out on it. Mm. And so for me, if someone tells me something about my race being the cause of, like, say, coronavirus, I need to speak up. And I encourage everyone else to speak up.
And has that happened to you?
It hasn't. And, you know, and from, you know, luckily, you know, my height and the fact that I'm bald, you know, people generally.
And you throw gang signs wherever you go.
People kind of ignore, yes. Like, just look past me. I'm sure they would like to. I mean, and yes. I'm not saying it'll never, because I'm sure there's some, some guy will always want to be like, you know, hey, I'm going to go and take on the biggest guy.
Right.
But for me, it's more about just being able to speak up.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's something that I never had growing up. So,
and the other thing that I've heard you speak up about is your advocacy for special needs people. Yeah.
Just, I think all of us are special needs, to be really honest. Yeah. And by just really being open and understanding for those who need the help and to not be afraid to just, you know, say what you want. And,
well, buddy, I love you. I'm so grateful for our friendship, and I appreciate you coming on and sharing your story.
Thanks. This is great. I appreciate you having me on.
Such a sweet man and such an important person in my life. You know, if you go through life and you have even just a half dozen, even just one person that you feel like you can share truly whatever is going on with you and not feel judged, that is a gift, man. That is winning the personal lottery. Many thanks to Chris.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Let's dive into some surveys. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey, and this is filled out by a guy who calls himself Lazy Man 94. What are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? I'm writing this survey as I sit in my car, avoiding going to work and lying to my boss about why I can't make it into work. For context, I've lost 6+ jobs, probably more, in the past year due to my attendance, a large part of it being depressed and anxious. I need to get a better grip on my life, but it's hard without being able to afford therapy or medication management. Thank you for sharing that, man, and I am sorry that you are in that place. You might look into see if your local community has free therapy. You can also contact therapy providers, and a lot of times they will have economic hardship assistance. I think BetterHelp has that. Don't quote me on that, but you might look into that. Anyway, buddy, I'm sending you a hug, man. Depression fucking blows. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Roller Coaster Christy. I don't even know what that means. I just like it. What are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? You are unworthy of love, damaged and broken. Give up trying to practice self-love and self-care because I'll always feel this way. Boy, do a lot of us relate to having experienced that. Fuck. Thank you for that, Christy. This is an email that I got from Julie Mr. Johnny 18, and they write, "Our secret company provides male escort. We are looking for fit bad boy or good fucker who can satisfy our female clients. Apply here." They say our company provides male escort. I don't know if that means they want me to be the sole male escort, which would be a lot of pressure, a lot of pressure. And honestly, that would run up my gas bill. So I don't know if I'm ready to go solo. Let's get to the second part. We're looking for a fit bad boy. Well, fit, that rules me out. I am not fit, nor am I well endowed. In fact, if I'm going to be honest, that area has been referred to as unfortunate by more than one woman. But now we're getting to the part, good fucker. Oh, baby. One word, machine. I don't want to brag, but my bed has drag racing wheels. It's got the big fat ones on one end and then the little skinny ones on the other end. And, yeah. People can hear my engine roaring on the other side of town. My bed has a rear view mirror. Because what I like to do when I'm in charge, I look in that rear view mirror. And what do I just see dust. I just see the male population eating my dust. Now, this is, sounds like I'm maybe getting a little full of myself. This is information has been vetted and scientifically confirmed at more than one junior college. I should also mention that my bedroom has no roof. Why? Google Earth. You got to share it with people. I'd like to teach the world to sing, and I think that's how I do it. This is from the Shame and Secret Survey, and this is filled out by a guy. Pardon me, I'm all mixed up here. Who calls himself John C. And hold on, I'm all discombobulated. My bit just got me all turned upside down. He identifies as straight. He's in his 50s. He says he was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. He writes, parents were very removed emotionally and provided no boundaries. My mom once told my wife, we thought it was his job to basically raise himself, and if he had any questions, he'd ask. Wow. Wow. John was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. He writes, 1983, I was a junior in high school, a New England boarding school, and my 28-year-old French teacher from Paris abused me sexually. Oh my God, that is like out of one of those awful early 80s softcore movies. At the time, I thought it was great, although in hindsight, it's really fucked up. She had an apartment in one of the girls' dorms, and the only furniture she had was a mattress. The first day, she invited a fellow student, female, and I, to her apartment to get high, and after a couple of hours, the other student left with a wink, and we ended up having sex. This went on for a couple of months, and then The only thing we did in her apartment was have sex. This introduced me to anal sex, sex which is something I have an unhealthy connection to today. At one point, she drove me home for the weekend, and we met my parents where they were having dinner, and we joined for dessert. My parents didn't say a word about it. As a parent today, I would draw a serious boundary and deal with both the teacher and my kid. It hurts. My parents were not able to do this. And buddy, I hope, you know, my little comment at the beginning there about the movie did not come across as flippant and, or minimizing what happened to you, because that is what happened to you is fucking sexual abuse. Absolutely. You know, and even more than the age thing is the power dynamic. He's been emotionally abused. In my current marriage, my wife rages against me. This happens when I've done something dishonest, but at the same time, my behavior does not justify hers. Any positive experiences with abusers? I can't think of any positive experiences with the teacher who abused me other than giving me my only A in high school French. With my wife, I've worked to develop my voice when she is raging to tell her to stop and then to walk away. That is new for me. That's good, man. That is a good tool. I think one of the best tools when you're dealing with people who are mercurial or have no boundaries is to be willing, no matter where you are, to leave the room or hang up the phone or cut contact. Darkest thoughts. I fantasize about other men having sex with my wife. Sharing that, this still turns me on, which I'm ashamed of. Darkest secrets. I stole a lot of money from a job. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. In the past, the most powerful sexual fantasies were all S&M, of me dominating women. That's passed now for maybe 3+ years. Since then, it's predominantly been about other men having sex with my wife. Sharing these is a bit liberating, although nothing my therapist doesn't know. And sharing that makes me feel shameful. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? And why? To my wife, that I just want to restart somehow. I'm responsible for my actions, which have hurt you, and I truly regret that. And please step up and take responsibility for your actions against me. And that is such a common theme that couples struggle with, is using the other person's fuck up as future leverage. And it is awful being in a relationship where that goes on and you tolerate it, or even worse, where neither people know that that's not healthy. It is. I can't imagine having intimacy in a relationship where mistakes are weaponized. What, if anything, do you wish for? Peace inside my soul and self-worth. Have you shared these things with others? I have. I share with a men's group. It's positive to share, but I'm still stuck in a comfortable one-down place with my wife, and I hate that. I hate my side of this. If you guys haven't tried couples therapy, I think it would be really good, because having that objective voice in there can at least give your relationship a shot, a chance, if it's feeling like it doesn't have a chance now. How do you feel after writing these things down? It's freeing, and I feel lighter. Anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? My need to be right by lying and controlling has stopped helping me. It most likely stopped helping me a long time ago, and I'm grateful there are others who share these thoughts and experiences with me. Oh, so true. So true. This is a very fucking heavy survey. It is a cornucopia of trigger warnings. So, that being said, let's dive into this one. This is filled up by a woman who calls herself Aim Low. She identifies as bisexual. She was raised in her 30s. She says that she was raised in a stable and safe environment. She was the victim of sexual abuse and never reported it. She writes, besides the requisite college-aged, got drunk for the first time and was nearly raped, though it was my first ever sexual experience and the man was 20 years my senior. I was in a relationship, in fact engaged to a man for 2.5 years that was consistently sexually abusive. He was also my first, which hurts, but not as much as the literal toolbox he used to torture me. Wrenches, pliers, etc. on my nipples and vagina. There were other things he did, augmented by another hidden drawer in his bedroom with ropes, chains, whips, and paddles. I still think about it, even 10 years past. I struggle with feeling like it was my fault, like I could have done more to get out of the relationship, when, in fact, I did nothing. I felt like a non-person. The pain was irrelevant, and so was I. I also still struggle with guilt of things I did to him. Similar sexual kinks like whipping, hitting, using pliers, and a wrench on when I'm the least violent person in the world, and it felt wrong. She writes that she's been emotionally abused. I have many vivid memories of my time with this man. Highlights are waiting in bed while he drank in the other room, my headphones in, trying to get a little sleep before he would come in the room and have sex with slash torture me. Of his apologies, oh, I guess that's supposed to be or his apologies when he would drop to his knees in front of me looking so pathetic and sob and beg for forgiveness. He would leave me tied up on the bed for hours. Sometimes he would just be in the other room. Sometimes he would leave the apartment. I struggle with those memories still, of my body going numb, feeling like an animal. All in all, a mind fuck. He tore me away from my family, turned me against my sisters, turned me into someone I'm not. I feel so much shame about that. Any positive experiences with abusers? We had some good times, but those are hard for me to admit. I've demonized him so much that letting even a sliver of goodness feels like it would break me apart. We had a great time camping in the Badlands of South Dakota one summer. It was beautiful and out of that dark bedroom where we lived. I guess she means the dark bedroom. Back where their apartment. Oddly, one morning when I woke up before him and wandered into the cool morning air, finally able to breathe and be alone, my mom texted me that Michael Jackson had died. Long live the king. Darkest thoughts. Well, to start on a high note, I've been struggling with suicidal thoughts in the last few weeks, more so than I ever have. Seems like once I let those thoughts in, they come more often and easily. I think about hanging myself in the fax room at work. I hate my job, and there are plenty of wires in there, a ladder, etc. These thoughts scare me. I know I'm miserable right now. I know it may pass, but I'm scared of my own brain. I've also been spending a little too much time reading porn just to fall asleep. I understand what you mean, Paul, when you said a few weeks back in the surveys from a couple of years ago, that it's insane to waste hours on finding the exact right 8-second clip. It's very obsessive. I read fan fiction, actually, not porn. I used to watch hentai, tentacle porn stuff, because I got too many viruses. Stories about rape, underage non-consensual sex, sex with monsters and demons, anything that enters into the surreal seems to get me off, and I always imagine myself as the male. Somehow I want to know what it's like to have a penis and use it to absolutely destroy someone. I've never shared some of these fantasies with a partner. I would like to, somehow. I've never had an orgasm with another person unless it was mutual masturbation. Maybe I can finally admit I need more stimulation than vanilla sex. But that is scary to me, considering my history of sexual abuse. The last time I had sex, really sad sex with an old boyfriend, he did, and I did, talk dirty during sex, some really nasty things, and he strangled me a little, which felt amazing. Darkest secrets. December 12th of last year, I gave up on my recovery from anorexia. I consciously gave in a moment, in a day. It was that easy. I've since only been eating what is allowed, very restricted, and by allowed, I believe she means in, you know, accordance with her eating disorder, not her recovery from her eating disorder. Very restrictive and using the exercise bike 40 minutes, two times a day, 5 days a week. The absolutely gutting thing, the thing that fills me with such misery and rage, and to the soul confusion, is I haven't lost a lot of weight. How? How is that possible? About a month ago, I took a step further. I know you were wondering if that was possible. One of my ED behaviors was chewing and spitting. Last month, though I wasn't actually eating more than the minimum, I found out I had spent $844 on food, food that I chewed up and spit out. I've stopped doing that, cold turkey, because it may be the reason I haven't lost weight. I can never tell my family about this. They've been through too much already. My sister actually told me the last time I relapsed, "I'm tired of your shit." I almost wish this disorder would kill me, or at least be obvious to someone on the outside somehow, so that it can be, quote, worth it, unquote. It's hard to explain, but I can tell you, Paul, that no one, not another soul in this world, knows about this. I think about that as if looking at it from the outside and know how sad and lonely that is. No one, not one other person, knows how I feel. It sometimes feels like too much to hold in. Hence this survey. And I think I have corresponded with the author of this survey before. Sexual fantasies most powerful to you. I sort of answered this in the previous questions, wanting to be the man. I've only had limited experiences with girls, but I am almost sure that I might be fully gay, but I don't know, and it kills me. I'm too scared to get out there and find out. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I would want to tell people how much I'm struggling. I'm so tired of being alone, but I'm sure, absolutely sure, that it would not help. It would scare people away, make things fall apart, and ruin everything. It would change how people see me. That's too much. Is that vanity? Christ. And then she put sigh, S-I-G-H. That is your disease talking, telling you that everybody's going to run away, that it's going to make things worse, and it's going to ruin everything. No. No. I don't believe that. I believe it could help you, that it could help you begin to heal, help you be kind to yourself, just to have a counterpoint to that mean fucking voice that is torturing you. And it might be worth considering EMDR therapy, because, oh my God, the shit that you went through, I'm so sorry that you went through that. So sorry. What, if anything, do you wish for? A lobotomy? ? Sometimes that seems the only answer to what I really want, which is for this voice, the eating disorder voice, to not ever, ever say another fucking word. Also, the usual, someone to love, a family of my own, a three-season porch. Have you shared these things with others? It usually ends in hospitalization of some sort or friends distancing themselves. It is a terrible reality for me that every time I fought this thing, it's come back. Like Alien, it won't die. I'm so tired of getting knocked down over and over. And the music swells, and I get pats on the back. You are a fighter. You keep trying. And it feels so far from the brave little soldier that I could puke. How do you feel after writing these things down? Better. Amped up. Anything you'd like to share with someone who shares your thoughts or experiences? Don't wait. Your shit sticks around, and time slows for no man or woman. Like the Pink Floyd song, suddenly 10 years have got behind you. No one told you when to run. You may be 15, 20, 25, but you blink and you will be 35, 45, 55 with the same problems and less life to live. Thank you for that. Thank you for that, man. That was fucking heavy, and I appreciate you going deep, and I hope that felt beneficial for you to let some of those feelings out. And then finally, this is from the Love Survey, and this is filled out by Gia. And she writes, I love when my cat sits on my chest in the morning and waits for slumber to fade from my head, then meows like she's been shot for a treat I keep in the bedside drawer. I love when I get in from a morning run in the rain and jump into the warm shower, then have 30 seconds of pure cold water only before I jump out. I love when I have dinners all prepared and ready to go before I get home from work. Oh, that is a great one. That or really good leftovers like Indian food. Oh, Indian food. Sweet, sweet Indian food. Is there anything better than a good chicken tikka masala? I love walking past some place and smell a flower or fragrance that reminds me of a place and time that I forgot. That is such a great one, too. I love when my son says, I love you, back to me. I love when I can overcome my insecurities, even if it's just for a minute or two. I love the peace I feel in a forest, the feel of the leaves and sticks underfoot, the smell of moss or fresh rainfall. I love hearing my friends' journeys on the forum and how they've interpreted into my world as supporting grew, as I'm too ashamed to tell the people around me I'm struggling. I love when I hear a podcast that resonates with me. Then you listen a second time and get the bits you missed because your brain was too busy exploding over the fact that someone out there understands you. Those are awesome. Thank you for those, Gia. Thank you. I'm so grateful when you guys fill out a survey that gives me something nice to end an episode on. It's such a relief. It is truly a gift to me when I read those, or the ones that give us an awfulsome moment right before the montage and the opening of this show. Speaking of the montage, I'd like some feedback from any of you that feel like giving it. Do you feel that the montage runs too long? That I could shorten that up? I think the opening montage runs around like a minute, and even though I change it every year, I'm just wondering if I should shorten that up when I come out with a new one for 2023. Anyway. There you have it. I hope you guys got something out of this episode, and just never forget that you are not alone, and thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.